Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament lectionary podcast for preachers, teachers, and all of God's creatures. I'm Reverend Dr. Rachel Wren, Assistant Professor of Biblical Studies at Trinity Lutheran Seminary at Capital University.
And I'm Reverend Dr. Tim McMinch. I teach Hebrew Bible at Christian Theological Seminary. So, hey, friends, we are in the Easter season, which for the lectionary means, who cares about the Old Testament?
This just makes me mad.
I know. But hey, we're going to make the most of it by giving you a series this Easter season that we're calling Hebrew Bible Scholars Read the Book of Revelation.
Let's do the apocalypse.
So we are going to do our best to give you some preaching tips and some preaching angles for the readings out of the Book of Revelation that are in the lectionary during the season of Easter. And to kick it off for us, we have none other than our Psalms scholar, Rachel Wren.
Because there's a lot of resonance between Psalms and the Book of Revelation.
Well, there's a lot of resonance between the Psalms and everything.
That's right. It all comes back to the Psalms. Exactly. So the Book of Revelation is actually one of my favorite books of the Bible. No joke. I know I say that a lot, but it's true. I've taught a class on Revelation a couple of times, and actually one of my main points is that to really understand the Book of Revelation well, you need to understand the Hebrew Bible well. So I'm going to do a little bit by way of intro of kind of drawing in the Hebrew Bible in just some general ways, but I will zero in on Revelation 1, 4 through 8 and talk a little bit about a preaching angle that, especially if you're kicking off a series, I think you could use pretty well. So let me start by saying, like, you will never regret doing a sermon series or a Bible study series on the Book of Revelation. It is a hot topic. Highly popular. People are fascinated by it, repelled by it, but they're drawn to it either way. It draws us in. It has very deep power. So, you know, if you're kind of running out of steam after a long Lent and you're trying to figure out how to make it through Easter, this is not a bad way to do it. You will have some immediate buy-in and you won't have to convince people to be interested by it. Just put a flyer with a zombie on it and say, Revelation Bible Study.
That'll work. When I was pastoring, I did a series on Revelation one year. It was a super hot summer. And so we just spent like the dog days of summer doing the series that we billed as the Hotter in Hell Summer Apocalypse series.
That's great. Conversely, I did it in the dead of winter in Minnesota, it was the most well-attended Bible study I've ever done. And the last day was a legit blizzard and everybody still came. You won't regret doing it, but you use the word, Tim, apocalypse. And I think that's an important place to start. So preachers, forgive us if this is a little bit of, repeat, but you know, stick with us here. Apocalyptic literature is something that really started actually in our last episode. Isaiah 65, the end of the book of Isaiah, is what we would call proto-apocalyptic literature. We're starting to see some of the themes of apocalyptic literature show up in the Hebrew Bible, shows up in Ezekiel and in Daniel as well. But that's really it. It is a type of literature that really takes up steam in the intertestamental times. And by the time we get to Jesus's time, it's kind of in full bore. So let me back up a little bit. What's apocalyptic literature? If I'm talking a pithy, kind of short, fun little succinct phrase, I would say it's unveiling for times of turmoil and trauma. So apocalypse in Greek does not actually mean end times or end of the world or anything like that. It just means an unveiling, a revelation. A new way of seeing things. And it comes out always of these situations of turmoil and trauma. So if you're going to talk about the Book of Revelation, just make sure that you start it, maybe in every single sermon, with talking about how the Book of Revelation was apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic literature came out of historical scenarios of turmoil and trauma. And really, it's no different than today. When we see communities undergo great trauma today, we see a shift in the way they talk about themselves, think about themselves, the kind of media that they present to the world. Because one of the things they're doing is trying to process what the heck just happened to them and how does it have meaning and sense? So that's where the word trauma becomes real important. We kind of throw that word around, but from a scientific perspective, what makes an event traumatic is the fact that it resists our normal meaning-making mechanisms. It's so much suffering, or it's so hard, or it's so unbelievable that we cannot work it into the way we understand the world. And so it just floats. And we can't ever bring it in to kind of enfold it into the way we make sense of the world. And that's one of the things that makes it traumatic.
I like the way that you talked about apocalyptic literature as a kind of genre, that it's worth reminding people that this is a certain kind of text.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because if we just are reading it straight off the page, it's really easy for us to misinterpret it as a kind of historical story or prediction of what's going to happen, you know, on the ground at a particular day and time. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the type of literature it is.
It's not. And if you want preachers or Tim or whoever is listening right now, grandma, if you want a quick intro into that sort of genre of apocalyptic from this early time period, go to OnScript Podcast. Just Google OnScript, one word, OnScript Podcast, Dr. Megan Henning, H-E-N-N-I-N-G. Mm. She's a New Testament scholar, and she has a book that she does an interview on called Educating Early Christians Through the Rhetoric of Hell.
Wow.
Yeah, great title. But what she talks about is how apocalyptic literature was a genre that was actually intended to educate people. And people had an expectation when they came to an apocalyptic performance, whether it was written or, you know, even acted out, they would have been familiar with that genre and they would have expected certain things of it. And one of the things she points out is that they would have been expected to be scared out of their boots. Like, that was something that they understood. It was a way of trying to communicate something to them, to educate them about something. And the rhetoric that they used was essentially the contemporary of our rhetoric of horror today.
Yeah, I started to think that as you were describing it, of how, you know, the horror genre, we're not meant to take everything that happens in a horror flick.
Yes.
Like super seriously or literally,
yes.
But it evokes something in us that we do find in real life.
Yes. And right? The best horror movies have a sort of social commentary underneath. So when the mm-hmm. zombie genre became really important, it was actually a critique of consumerism and how consumerism yeah. turns us into these mindless consuming zombies. So there's, you know, you could play with that horror image, that horror genre. You could also Jordan Peele's Get Out is another relevant one that would be really, you know, again, social commentary about white liberals and the way we are willing to do damage to black bodies to feel good about ourselves. So anyway, getting us back on track, this is not a prediction of the end of time. It was never intended as a prediction of end of time. What it was an intention to try to educate or convince us of something. And that's actually where we get into our pericope for today. It's really short, which is helpful. If you're going to do this sermon series and you want to spend some time setting up the sermon series, this is a good time to do it because it's very short. It's basically just a description of, you know, John, who this person is, to the seven churches in the province of Asia. And that's actually what I want to focus on, again, because this is kind of setting up the conversation, but to lead into your first sermon, you're going to have to do a little bit of heavy lifting in terms of context. It's important to note for that context that these were seven actual cities in today's modern day Western Turkey. So this is not Israel, Palestine that's being written to. This isn't, you know, Italy. This is Western Turkey. Asia Minor is kind of that general area. The dominant language and culture was Greek. It was all Roman rule. And all of these were communities of Christians. These communities were struggling with three main issues. But before I get to those three main issues, I want to address verse 1, which isn't in this pericope. But I just, you know, again, if you're going to have people come up to you afterwards, I want you to be prepared. It says, the revelation from Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. Okay, that phrase, what must soon take place. That's where we get a lot of the prediction, the end of the world, the, you know, this is about to happen. This is not necessarily about, in fact, it's not all about the end of the world, because again, we have seven actual cities in Western Turkey, and chapters 2 and 3 tell us a lot about those historical cities that this stuff was happening to. It's dealing with stuff that's happening right here and now. It's kind of like in the last week when you were talking about Hineni and how God's like, watch this. Yeah. Like, this is about to happen. You know, I'm drawing your attention to it because it's like right now, right now. So mm-hmm. these chapters are talking about what must take place in their own context and take place soon because they're struggling with three things. They're struggling with persecution, assimilation, and complacency. Now, important note, they're not all struggling with those things. As they describe right. in chapters 2 and 3, these seven cities are, you know, some of them are dealing with persecution. Other cities are dealing with assimilation. Others are dealing with complacency. The persecution, just a quick word on each, the persecution was probably local. There's not great evidence that it was this emperor, top-down kind of thing. It was local because as Christians were pulling people away from Greco-Roman worship, they were pulling people away from the local temples. And the local temples were the local economy. So Christians were literally bad for business. So the persecution yeah. was probably local. That doesn't make it any less bad, but just as you're, you know, as you're preaching, don't blame the emperors because it probably wasn't them. So first problem, persecution. Other cities were dealing with assimilation. How can you be true to your convictions while socially trying to get along with people who don't share your faith? To what extent can you compromise your faith without going too far? How do you maintain your religious identity in an interreligious world? Now, that one might be applicable to a lot of people. You know, how do you do that?
It's possible.
Right. It's possible, just maybe. And the third one also just possible maybe, which was complacency. The Christians at Laodicea have become complacent because of their wealth. It just says it right there in those chapters. The material comfort that they have has sapped the vitality of their faith. And so they thought they didn't need anything from God. So what we have is the book of Revelation that is written to three different audiences, the persecuted, the assimilated, and the complacent. The goal of all three of those communities is not to make anyone despair. It's to open people's eyes or to open their awareness to what you were talking about with Isaiah, the reality that is underneath everything that seems to be going on. You mm-hmm. seem persecuted. Yes, I know that's the case, but the Lamb, the slaughtered one, is actually the king of the world, of all the cosmos. You think you're assimilated. You think that you can just kind of skate on by. Well, I think you should think twice about that because the stakes are higher than it might just seem. And you think that you don't need anything? Oh, friend, let me tell you what is happening to you. Mm-hmm. I think that that's, you know, that's a lot of historical context and that's a lot of really just general context. But putting it in those terms of persecuted, assimilated, and complacent can then set up the rest of your sermon series to dig into one or several of those.
Yeah, that's super helpful. And I'm curious what you would say, Rachel, about this particular like four verses or so, verses 4 through 8. Having given some of that background, set up what type of literature this is, what advice would you have for preachers for bringing it home as like a sermon in Easter on this half a paragraph?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the delightful things is verse 4. John, to the seven churches in the province of Asia, grace and peace to you from he who is and who was and who is to come, and from the seven spirits before his throne. Just that first part, from he who is and who was and who is to come. There's a really fun play going on there. It messes with all of the Greek rules. Like, it doesn't make sense. It's nonsensical in the Greek. And what's so wonderful about that is that this author recognizes that communicating the reality about God goes beyond our ability to use language. It goes beyond our ability to communicate sensibly. It's almost this sense of when we're going to communicate about God, we need to break the grammatical rules. We need to break the logic of metaphor. The resurrection, what it does is turn everything upside down. Verse 5 is something that sounds really familiar to our ears. To him who loves us and has freed us from our sins by his blood, blah, 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 the blood of the Lamb, the blood of Jesus. We sing a lot about that. Like, what excuse me? Look, this is huge. This is insane. And it just keeps going. So I'm struggling a little bit to come up with a sermon angle, because I think one of the joys about the book of Revelation is it too resists what we do in trying to preach from it. Mm-hmm. What it's trying to get us to do is to see the world in a completely different way than we're used to. So how would you draw that attempt, you know, if you were trying to get your congregation to see the world in a completely different way, or to be aware of the world in a completely different way than they're used to, how would you do that? Like, what would you draw into this moment that could really tip you into the book of Revelation for the rest of Easter?
And I think the one who is and who was and who is to come, the way that messes with time is, I think, maybe a really helpful way into the book of Revelation, because it's so often interpreted as a prediction of the far off future, or the last things, eschatology. And yet there's an eternally present, or like, it's the one who was and who will, but also like who is right now. Yeah. That's getting messed with in a fun way with that phrase, that way of describing the Holy One. And it's a phrase that pops up several times in Revelation, including even again in this pericope in verse 8. Mm-hmm. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, another like messing with time type of thing.
The first,
the one who is and was and is to come.
Yeah.
The other thing that we haven't really touched on yet is verse 7.
Mm-hmm.
Look, he's coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him. So this is referring to the pierced one, Jesus. Mm-hmm. And yet it's drawing upon language of Daniel 7, right? And of the Son of Man, the human one who comes on the clouds. Mm-hmm. So it's a picture of perhaps the return of Christ. You know, the one who disappeared into the clouds, you'll see him come in the same way, says the author of the book of Acts.
Mm-hmm.
But also the sense of Daniel 7, the one who's given authority to rule and reign God's world is one who's coming on the clouds.
Yeah. And I think that's really important, too, because Daniel 7, because it's apocalyptic literature, is often made to be that foretelling. It's talking about the future, when Daniel really was talking about the time frame that the people were living in right then and there. So to say this, look, he is coming with the clouds. Again, it's not foretelling. It's hineni. It's look right now, like see it happening. It may not seem like it is, but the really real thing is that Jesus is coming with the clouds and is seeable and touchable. And, you know, we can actually experience him now, even though, I mean, that's where I kind of like the phrase apocalypse now, because it's a new scene now, you know.
Well, there's your series title.
There you go. Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now. Well, awesome. I think that's probably a great place to wrap up here as an introduction to the series on Revelation. And, you know, we've given you a few insights, a few tips, some context. We would love to hear what plans you come up with for your sermons. If you are going to take this on as a series, give us some feedback. Let us know what direction you spun your sermon series with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can do that on our website, firstreadingpodcast.com, in the comment sections, or in many of the places where you get podcasts, where there is an opportunity to leave us a review or to give us some feedback. On the YouTube channel, you can find us there as well. And there's a place for comments on the videos, or on Facebook, where you can also find us. Let's make this into a conversation and give us some preaching tips from what you gleaned from our little forays here into the book of Revelation. Well, we're looking forward to the next rounds of this. And until then, I'm Tim McNinch.
And I'm Rachel Wren. Happy apocalypse.
Happy apocalypse.